masterpiece. And maybe I had miles to drive and promises to keep. You ditch it all to stay alive. A thousand kisses deep.
My name is Nevaeh. I lost my foot in a lawnmower accident. Now I teach other children how to play safe. Kids shouldn't play near lawnmowers. Lawnmowers are very loud. The driver wouldn't be able to hear you if you were playing anywhere near. It's very important to be cautious.
Whatever game you play, play safe.
A message from the War Amps. Learn more at waramps.ca.
Good morning. You're listening to CILU 102.7 FM. I'm Joshua with It's Pretty Trivial. Hopefully everyone's having a good week this week, and I hope everyone's enjoying their week. This week, I will bring a good episode for you on Remembrance Day. Remembrance Day is after the airing of this episode, tomorrow. So, it'll be played the day before Remembrance Day on the 10th of November. I think it's a good time to take a look at Remembrance Day, a little bit of the history, and how maybe, World War I and II shaped the Canada we know. I think it's an important day to look into World War I and II, and really what it helped create. Many people know that the Battle at Vimy Ridge helped reshape Canada into the country it is today. And after that, World War II as well really helped solidify the Canadian identity. So without further ado, let's get into it. Today I'm actually getting my facts from a special commemorative issue of Canadian Geographic from 2014, but it's a special one that has some pretty good facts in it. Hopefully we'll cover the whole episode with facts on Remembrance Day. If I have to, I'll find some other facts elsewhere as well, but there's quite a few in the National Geographic magazine. Now the first is, what year was World War One? The days and the year. From July 28th, 1914 to November 11th, 1918 is one of the most pivotal eras for Canadian history. It was the First World War, which changed much about our country. Now, this commemorative magazine was actually created to commemorate the 100-year anniversary of the starting of World War One. Now, a lot of these are important facts. One that I'd like to look at kind of extensively is the Battle of Vimy Ridge, because that is very important, as it kind of created the Canada we know. Now, World War One is also known by another name, which is what? World War One is also known as the Great War. Now, instantly recognizable to millions around the world, the red bloom of the poppy keeps the memory of those who fought and died in the war alive. This poppy is the symbol of Remembrance Day and November 11th. And I'm sure everyone wears it, or most people wear it on Remembrance Day to commemorate it. To all those men and women that went and fought, mainly men during World War One and some women in World War Two, and in modern day, the people that fight in these wars and may lose their lives, it's a symbol of sacrifice. Especially back then, when it was all conscription, you were forced to go to war for your country. Now, the biggest memory of the Great War is the poppy. And not only is it known in Canada, it's an international symbol of remembrance. Here's a little bit of story about the poppy. It grew naturally in Western Europe and was one of the few plants to take hold in the churned earth of the First World War's battlefields and graveyards. Canadians came to know the know that poppies grow and blow in Flanders fields. Through the words of who was a Canadian surgeon and soldier who observed firsthand the hardy flowers on the graves of his comrades. John McCrae, who was a Canadian soldier and surgeon. He wrote the very famous poem in Flanders Fields, which really started the whole wearing of the poppy and helps as one of the grim reminders of World War I. This poem is heard very, very commonly at almost any Remembrance Day ceremony, and it's an extremely famous poem about the war. In what year was the poppy adopted as a symbol of remembrance in Canada? 1921 links the past and present, that distant conflicts, to today. It's worn annually by millions of Canadians, and it sends an unequivocal message that Canadians have not forgotten their sacrifice of those who gave their lives in the First World War. Each year, the Royal Canadian Legion organizes the Poppy Campaign. In 1948, an act of Parliament gave the Legion the responsibility to preserve the symbol of the poppy, to ensure it is not exploited for commercial purposes, and to keep in trust the proceeds from poppy sales to support veterans. The annual Poppy Campaign begins when the Legion presents the Governor General with the first poppy. Which is when? So on the last Friday of October, the then more than 1,400 local branches of the Legion start offering poppies to the public. 18 million poppies are produced annually in Canada, generating some $14 million. Canadians wear the poppy as a sign of respect and gratitude. It is an individual act that resonates as both a personal and collective symbol of remembrance. It's never more evident than on Remembrance Day, at the end of service in Ottawa, those in attendance remove their poppies and place them on the National War Memorial, a symbol that we have not forgotten, those who died. Wearing a poppy and taking a moment of silence has been a long tradition for Canadians each November. Many don't know that paying tribute to those who served and died in Canada's wars began with Armistice Day, when at 11 a.m. on November 11th, 1918, the conflict on the Western Front of the First World War officially ended. The following year, Britain began the tradition of honoring war veterans on the second Monday of each November. In 1921, the Canadian government passed an Armistice Day bill that memorial ceremonies would take place the week of November 11th, around the same time that Thanksgiving used to take place. It wasn't until 1931 that November 11th was set as the official day as a National Remembrance Day. Though it's still called Armistice Day, and some still call it that in some places, Remembrance Day pays tribute not only to the soldiers of the First World War, but also those of the Second World War, the Korean War, and all other battles and peacekeeping efforts, which together account for deaths of more than 100,000 Canadian. Now, the next is a little bit about a base. Now, Valcartier has its origins in the First World War. It was a life for over 33,000 soldiers at the Valcartier military camp, and on September 13th, 1914, including Private Goldwyn Peary, who wrote about his experience in the Ontario Dundas Star, his hometown newspaper. The undeveloped, about 25 kilometers northwest of Quebec City, had been purchased by the Canadian government in 1913. And was to be used as a training area for militia in the province. But when Canada entered war on August 4th, the government had acted quickly to ready Valcartier for Piri and the tens of thousands of other volunteers who would arrive the following months. In a matter of weeks, teams of lumberjacks cleared woodland, a firing range was built, temporary and permanent buildings were constructed, electric lighting installed, telephone and telegraph connections to Quebec City were established, roads were built, and rail tracks were laid. With easy access to the provincial capital's port, Valcartier, which remains a Canadian force base today, soon became the largest military camp on Canadian soil, eventually occupying 50 square kilometers and accommodating 59,116 men between 1914 and 17. By October 1914, 31,200 of the men who had been stationed at the camp were sailing to England. For many, including Peary, who died on July 1, 1915, after being wounded at the Second Battle of Ypres, the sandy flats, former farm fields, and wooded ridges of Valcartier would be the last Canadian soil they ever set foot on. Before the war broke out in July 1914, Canadian Army numbered how many men? The Canadian Army numbered a mere 3,110 men. By September, however, volunteers had swelled the ranks of the newly created Canadian Expeditionary Force to about 33,000. The idea of fighting for king and country drew many, but so did the exhortations of recruitment posters, which, like the British Army version pictured below, which is, "Your chums are fighting, why aren't you?" played on everything from patriotic fervor and a sense of guilt to the parallels between football and battle. By the end of 1915, 330,000 had volunteered, more than half of the 619,636 who would enlist during the war. Many people have probably seen a lot of these propaganda posters in Canada, the US, the UK, trying to get people to come out and fight for their country. Now, in the first bit, well, Canadian posters were everywhere from the start, and they're known, but a lot of the American ones known weren't until a little bit after, as the Americans didn't join the war right away. Now, the First World War may have shaped the Canadians' international reputation, but it also shaped us here at home. All Canadians flocked to cities to reap the benefits of the war boom. Rail companies faltered under colossal debt, airports appeared, and internment camps for enemy aliens were built to placate fearful Canadians. There's a map as a snapshot at specific moments between 1914 and 18 and the culminative change to the country during that time, and captures the infrastructure that was important. There's actually a few interesting ones where it shows a lot of major military bases. It actually shows, well, major CEF training camps. And there was actually one right here in Thunder Bay. It also shows armories, which it says we have two. I'm not sure if we still have two anymore, but I know we still have the one armory right near Waverly Park. And we have the naval base, HMCS Griffin, on Algoma Street. Thunder Bay was important as the 52nd Battalion was part of Thunder Bay. Many people went and fought, and I myself have had great uncles who fought in World War II. My great grandfather on my mother's side fought in World War I, and I'm sure I have other family that fought during the war. Now, there were wartime hubs during the war, and it relied heavily on armories to muster and train troops. And it was located close to chief transport routes, and they were already home to Canadian militiamen who experienced the recent Boer War and in major training exercises were put to good use preparing the expeditionary force for recruitment to battle. There was also many things like a transport boom, training camps, Royal Flying Corps stations, naval signal stations, and some cities, which were getting ready to help, which helped create the economy, an economic boom, and it stimulated urbanization in Canada, and it turned many rural Canadians heading into cities to find employment in factories and other booming industries. And it also created the alien internment camps. There is a lot of interesting facts about, well, Canada during the war. But there's one thing many people don't realize, and that during World War I and II, many, many economic countries had an economic boom. After the Great Depression, believe it or not, one way that Germany recovered so well from the Great Depression was, as bad as this is to say, Hitler actually saved them from economic disaster. During the late 30s, when he started to create a war-type economy. And as horrible as he was, he did help the economy in Germany. And then when Canada, the U.S., and many other countries went to war in World War II, their economies actually boomed. And there was a lot of talks that wartime economies are some of the best economies. Now, and then here is some other interesting facts about it. During the First World War, there was a major shaping of Canadian politicians. Two of the country's eventual greatest leaders, youths during the conflict, were sent home before they could see action. At the same time, many of the country's most promising youth leaders, such as a pair of Montrealers, were lost. John Diefenbaker was Prime Minister from 1957 to 63. Diefenbaker trained with the Canadian Expeditionary Force in England, but was sent home when found unfit for service. In 1960, his government enacted the Canadian Bill of Rights, the first federal protection of human rights and basic freedoms. Lester B. Pearson was Prime Minister from 1963 to 68. Pearson joined the Royal Flying Corps in 1917 after volunteering as a stretcher bearer in Greece for 2 years. He was struck by a bus in London before seeing action, then sent home unfit for service. He won a Nobel Peace Prize in 1957 for proposing the first international peace force as a solution to the 1956 Suez Crisis. These are two famous Canadian prime ministers. The two that passed that were promising was a 26-year-old son of the former Bank of Montreal president G.A. Drummond, who was killed in 1915 during the Second Battle of Ypres in Belgium. Destined for politics, he was fluently bilingual, wealthy, and disarmingly modest. His death was considered a major blow by military and political leaders who had already deemed him future Prime Minister of Canada material. Guy's name was Guy Drummond. Second one was a Montreal lawyer who died in 1917 at Passchendaele, Belgium. 34-year-old Major Papineau was a Rhodes Scholar with a famous French-Canadian last name. In an open letter in Montreal Gazette in 1916, he publicly challenged his cousin Henri Bourassa, the chief opponent of Canada's role in the war, calling for a unified Canada. That was Talbot Papineau. Now the next one is conscription. Here is a quote. For French Canadians, the advent of conscription would trigger a process that would soon transform what is now perhaps the most peaceful and most orderly people in the Americas into a revolutionary people. Once unleashed, this revolutionary spirit would rage, not only against the military regime, but everywhere. On August 29th, 1917, shortly after the words of politician and journalist Henri Bourassa appeared in Le Devoir, conscription became law in Canada, and riots in Montreal and Quebec City followed. The advent of obligatory military service would create deep divisions between French and English Canada for decades to come, and leave a bitter legacy in Quebec, and fan the flames of nationalism in the province. Conscription was a very, very controversial subject back in the day. But it is not something that has happened since World War II. Let's hope it doesn't happen again. As much as people felt great to fight for their country, a lot of people were pulled away from their families to go fight for Canadians abroad. Many of them losing their lives and leaving family behind who may never have known their father or may not have known them well and have to deal with the fact that they may be buried in some field in France somewhere, perhaps in Flanders fields, and they will never see their loved one again. Now, there is also a lot of women who were in the war. There are four women in every Canadian should know, but many don't. Decades before the Second World War, when Molly Lamb Bodak became the first commissioned Canadian female war artist to go overseas, Henrietta Mabel May, Dorothy Stevens, Frances Loring, and Florence Weil were capturing what was happening to Canada during the First World War. The Canadian War Memorials Fund commissioned these four women near the end of the First World War as part of a program to generate art that reflected what was happening at the time. With more than 100 artists, the program was meant to be Canada's national record of its role in the war. While other Commonwealth countries were engaged in a similar exercise, Canada was unique because its program included art that reflected the home front and established the Canadian experience during the war as distinct from that of Britain. As part of portraying wartime Canada, May, Stevens, Loring, and Weil were asked to create art related to work in the factories and fields, especially focusing on women's work. Like most women at the time, the four artists would never see the bloody battlefields overseas. Before the war, many Canadian women remained in the domestic sphere as mothers and wives, staying at home to take care of their families. But when the men went to war, there was a shortage of workers, and women had to step into unfamiliar, traditionally male roles, taking jobs in factories and farming fields. Although women had to return to their homes after the war ended, giving jobs back to returning soldiers, this initial stint of the workforce eased women's return to the factory floor in the Second World War, and eventually aided in the greater fight for the right to work. Now, this was a lot of what was happening during the war. Men were not in Canada, they were overseas fighting, and they needed people to help pick up the slack where the men were now not in fighting. Where the men were out fighting, the women had to take up the slack. They had to create, you know, weapons, munitions, food, uniforms, where traditionally they weren't. This is kind of the start of the whole women's right and suffrage movements in Canada, and really helped create the idea that women should be allowed to vote and work and not just stay at home. Women's suffrage in the 1917 election spurred new voting rights for women. Suffragettes were already rallying in Canada before the start of the war, which was how Manitoba's women became the first to win the right to vote provincially in 1916. At the federal level, however, the war sped things up significantly. badly in need of votes and heading into an election where conscription was the main issue, Prime Minister Robert Borden stacked the deck in his favor by enacting the Wartime Elections Act in 1917, granting voting rights to wives, mothers, and sisters of serving soldiers and women in the armed forces. By 1918, those rights had been extended to all women 21 years and older, as long as they were not alien-born and met property requirements in provinces where they exist. It was some time before other women, particularly Aboriginal and Asian women, could vote, but the war years marked the start of women in Canadian politics. The last thing I will talk about before the break is the war auxiliary. Although work such as sewing and knitting was still an important part of the war effort, many women soon found themselves occupying non-traditional gender roles, employed at jobs that had been held by men who left to fight. Canadian women formed the Suffragettes War Auxiliary, which helped provide women with work in munitions factories. More than 30,000 did so. The civil service, at banks and offices, and on farms. Their contributions proved that women were as capable as men and aided to fight for gender equality in Canada. That isn't even half of the facts I have. And when we come back, I would like to talk a little bit more about some famous people and a famous poem that I hope to put on later. And I might, at the end of the episode, play a few Remembrance Day songs just as make you think and remember. So please stay tuned here on CILU 102.7 FM.
CILU is sponsored in part by the Students of Lakehead University, our listeners, and our sponsors. At this time, we would like to thank the following sponsors for their continuous support.
Lakehead Unitarian Fellowship, an inclusive spiritual community promoting a compassionate, just, and sustainable world. Find them online at luf.ca, on Facebook, or at 129 South Algoma, Sundays at 10:30 a.m. The Live from the Rock Folk Festival, bringing the spirit of folk and folk music to Red Rock every August. Keep up to date with upcoming happenings and buy tickets online at livefromtherockfolkfestival.com. The Outpost, Lakehead University's pub, full-service restaurant, and live music venue. Find them on Facebook to stay up to date on all the happenings during the school year, like Tanker Tuesdays and Pub Night Thursdays.
Welcome back. You're listening to CILU 102.7 FM. If you joined us in the first half, welcome back. If you're just joining us now, thanks for tuning in. In the first half, we were talking just about some interesting things that interesting effects of World War One. However, in the second half, I'd like to look a little bit more at the actual war itself. And I'm going to start with a few facts, but then I want to talk a little bit about probably one of the most important battles in Canadian history, and quite possibly one of the most internationally recognized poems, especially for Remembrance Day. So without further ado, let's get going. We're going to start with some few fun trivia facts I have found. And they might be a little tough, but let's hope they're good. What was the only First World War battle to appear in a place name north of Canada's 60th parallel? A. Passchendaele, B. Vimy Ridge, C. Ypres, or D. the Somme? Well, it was A, which was Passchendaele. The Yukon Somme Creek, about 260 kilometers northeast of Whitehorse. So Passchendaele was a district. Now, Berlin, Ontario, known as the German capital of Canada, was renamed Kitchener in 1916 after the local Board of Trade suggested that Berlin was bad for business, sent a message that citizens sympathize with the enemy of Europe. Which of these names were not considered by the city council before they settled on Kitchener? Homeland, London, Machano, Cosmos. The only one not considered was London. Canada's original Book of Remembrance, which contains the names of more than 66,000 Canadians who died because of the First World War, is displayed in the Memorial Chamber. And what landmark is the chamber contained? It is the Peace Tower. And the Peace Tower is the tall tower in the center block on Parliament Hill. I have actually visited that book, and I believe every little while they will turn a page in the book and slowly throughout the year display, or a couple years display, all the names of the Canadians who died. This 3,363-meter peak is the tallest mountain visible from the town of Jasper, Alberta. In 1916, it was renamed after a British nurse whom the Germans had executed the year before in Belgium. Who was this war hero? Dorothy Fielding, Florence Nightingale, Mary Chisholm, Edith Cavell. Was Edith Cavell, who helped more than 200 Allied soldiers escape to safety. This celebrated Canadian soldier's remains were exhumed from a war cemetery near Vimy Ridge and reinterred in Canada in 2000. Who is he? It's the unknown soldier. True or false? In one example of rampant anti-German sentiment in Canada during the war, Ottawa residents started calling Frankfurters hot dogs. It was seen as a means of cutting ties to the German language and culture. False. Though Winnipeggers did start referring to hamburgers as nips. The only artifact in Canadian War Museum's Memorial Hall is a headstone of the unknown soldier, imported from a war cemetery in northern France. What happens to this grave marker every Remembrance Day at exactly 11 a.m.? A sunbeam will illuminate it. The next one is, as local men started returning to Orillia, Ontario from the Great War, some of the city's leaders decided to set up a different type of memorial, one that was both commemorative and practical. What was it? A park, a hospital, a church, the First Royal Canadian Legion. It was a hospital, which offered free hospitalization and medical care, even surgery, to veterans for the rest of their lives. The Canadian National Historic Site is best known as the main arrival point and quarantine for European immigrants during the cholera and typhus outbreaks of the 1800s. During and after the First World War, however, tens of thousands more Europeans passed through it, many escaping the widespread devastation of their continent. The largest ammunition plant in Canada, and possibly in the Commonwealth, opened and transformed the small community's economy during the war. In 1918, the town suffered a major setback when a factory caught fire and exploded. Today, the city is the site of a Canadian Forces base. Is it Petawawa, Ontario, Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, Trenton, Ontario, or Valcartier, Quebec? It is Trenton, Ontario. What National Hockey League trophy, established in 1925, has ties to a Vimy Ridge war hero and goes to the most gentlemanly and skilled player of the year? Is it the Vezina Trophy, the Hart Memorial Trophy, the Prince of Wales Trophy, or the Lady Byng Memorial Trophy? It's the Lady Byng Memorial Trophy. Lady Byng was the wife of Lord Julian Byng, leader of the Canadian Corps at Vimy Ridge. Known as a response, a troop of bronze figures charges through the arch of the National War Memorial in Ottawa. How many figures are there in all? 22, 11, 8, or 33? There is 22 figures. The Caribou Monument in northern France faces former German lines and is one of five memorials in France and Belgium that honors which specific group of Canadians? Northerners, foresters sent to Europe, Canadians who fought with foreign forces, or Newfoundlanders? It's Newfoundlanders. They fought as a separate force, as Newfoundland did not join Confederation until 1949. True or false? During and after the war, the British Empire collected its dead from battlefields and makeshift graves and shipped the fallen soldiers' remains to their home countries. False. Instead, they buried them near the battlegrounds where they had fallen. Exchange the stick and puck for a Ross rifle and a bayonet, and take your place in the great army that is being forced to sweep the oppressors of humanity from the face of the earth. That was James T. Sutherland, president of the Ontario Hockey Association, calling for players to join the war in 1915. What major annual cup tournament did the Kingston-born Hockey Hall of Famer help to create in 1919? The Memorial Cup. True or false? To help persuade returning soldiers to settle and farm in the prairie provinces after the First World War, the Canadian government came up with plans for tiny houses that cost less than $800 and took no longer than 8 days to assemble. That is true. This well-beloved British general commanded the Canadian Expeditionary Force at Vimy Ridge and was later the first Governor General of Canada, to the break of tradition by appointing Canadian forces of officers as his aide-de-camp. Was it Albert Grey, 4th Earl of Grey, Lord Julian Byng, Charles Vincent Massey, or Sir Arthur Currie? Was Lord Julian Byng, later Viscount Byng of Vimy? There's a bunch of stained glass windows, which appear in the Canadian Memorial Church, show a Canadian nursing sister and an amputee of the First World War. Where is the church? Is it Halifax, Brussels, Belgium, Vancouver, or Port Perry, Ontario? The church is in Vancouver. True or false? Out of more than 125 Canadian place names that commemorate First World War battles and locations, Vimy Ridge occurs more than any other. That's true. When they first skated onto the ice in 1917, this Canadian hockey team had just been named in honor of one of the country's most celebrated military icons. Today it is the oldest continually operating junior hockey club anywhere. Is it the Regina Pats, the Drummondville Baltigers, Victoria Royals, or Windsor Spitfires. It is a Regina Pats, named after Princess Patricia, Canadian Light Infantry, the first Canadian combat unit to go into action in the First World War. That is all of the trivia questions I wanted to cover. The next bit I'd like to talk about is about the first, the Battle of Vimy Ridge, which is one of the biggest and most important battles in Canadian history. Now, before we get on to that, I just quickly like to talk about a few smaller facts before we continue. Many people are being devastated by the coronavirus right now. But a little over 100 years ago, there was a global pandemic that swept through Canada just as bad as this. It killed millions around the globe. And when bullets and bombs drew to a close in 1918, this would kill millions more with disease that was starting to spread. Although the origins of this pandemic, which killed 50 million worldwide and 50,000 in Canada alone, more deaths than any other epidemic previously recorded, remain unknown. There are three main theories where it began: an American army camp in Kansas, the trenches of Europe, or Asia. Mark Humphreys, a history professor at Memorial University in St. John's, believes it could be the latter. He published a paper that shed light on the flu's possible spread from China to Canada and beyond. Now, this pandemic killed a lot of soldiers, and they may have survived the war, but they may not have survived the pandemic. This pandemic was the Spanish flu, and after the world had been devastated by the Great War, it was then devastated by a horrible flu epidemic that is probably the likes of what the coronavirus would be today. I don't know which is worse, but I can tell you this much. A lot of people are comparing this coronavirus and saying the last time we had something major like this was just after the First World War with the Spanish flu. Now, before we continue on to talking about one of the most important Canadian battles, I'd like to talk a little bit about an important treaty. Prime Minister Robert Borden, House of Commons debates, September 2nd, 1919, said this: "The same indomitable spirit which made Canada capable of that effort and sacrifice made her equally incapable of accepting at the peace conference, in the League of Nations, or elsewhere, a status inferior to that accord of to nations less advanced in their development, less amply endowed in wealth, resources, and population, no more complete in their sovereignty, and far less conspicuous in their sacrifices." As the Allied nations carved out the terms of the Treaty of Versailles at the Paris Peace Conference in June 1919, Borden fought for Canada to have its own membership in the League of Nations and its own signature on the treaty. Although it was indented below Great Britain, it was the first time Canada was recognized as its own entity on the world stage, and foreshadowed the full independence that would come with the Statute of Westminster in 1931. The Treaty of Versailles was the signing of the end of World War One, where the largest countries at the time, Soviet Union, Great Britain, the United States, and in a little part Canada and a few other nations, signed the treaty, as well as France was there, signing the treaty to end World War I. This treaty was supposed to end all wars and stop any war from ever happening again. Ironically, this was one of the things that, one of the greatest factors that led to World War II. Germany signing it said that they could only have a certain size military and had very stringent restrictions on how big their forces could be. And these rules were to prevent Germany from starting another war. However, in the 30s, when Hitler came to power, he ripped up the Treaty of Versailles and started taking up arms and creating a great military. And he believed that the Treaty of Versailles was one of the worst things to ever happen in Germany. And this treaty later led to Hitler starting World War II and a battle just as great, maybe even worse, than World War I itself. World War II is also celebrated in Remembrance Day, especially as there are still some World War II veterans left. And again, Canadians would fight in the fields of France. Maybe not the same as during World War I, but they would still fight in France with things like D-Day. Now, this next bit I'm going to talk about is an important Canadian battle. This also gave rise to an iconic Canadian statue and important in Canadian lore. As dawn broke on April 9th, 1917, close to 100,000 Canadian soldiers began filling out of the tunnels and trenches and crossing no man's land under one of the fiercest artillery barrages ever unleashed. By 7:30 a.m., the first objectives had been taken. By 2 p.m. the following day, all but one of the four Canadian divisions had secured their final objectives. The last remaining piece of German resistance, a heavily fortified hill known as the Pimple, fell on April 12th. And with that, Canada's most celebrated war victory, the Battle of Vimy Ridge, was completed. More than any other battle in the First World War, including some, such as the Hundred Day Offensive, that were more strategically significant than others, such as the Battle of the Somme, that were costly in terms of Canadian lives. Basically, it was one of the most bloodiest battles in Canadian history. Vimy quickly came to symbolize Canadian military capability, national pride, and identity. It had a profound influence on the way Canadians saw themselves, no longer as a collection of immigrants and provincials, but as a unified country able to hold its own with the great powers of Europe. There are a number of reasons why Vimy is singled out for this type of national myth-making, starting with the fact that it was the first time all four divisions of the Canadian Corps fought together. More to the point, the Canadians succeeded where the others had failed. The French in particular suffered some 140,000 casualties in a half dozen unsuccessful attacks. The Canadians took the ridge in 4 days with fewer than 4,000 soldiers dead. It wasn't the most significant battle, but it fit a particular Canadian narrative, said Tom Cook, a World War I historian and author. It was the first major victory for the Canadian Corps after 2 years fighting and heavy casualties. Moreover, few thought they'd succeed because the German defenses at Vimy were considered almost impregnable. Cook said that the spectacular breakthrough at Vimy came down to extensive preparation and training, together with new tactics and techniques. This battle was one for the history books. Canadians fought side by side, and they practiced it extensively. They had to learn exactly 100 yards, stop, walk 100 more yards, stop, walk 100 more yards, stop, walk 100 more yards, stop. If they didn't do this exactly right, they would be killed by artillery fire shooting in front of them. They devised this plan where they'd use indirect fire, and they'd shoot the artillery in front of the men and kind of create a smoke screen. There's stories of German soldiers who, before they even realized what was happening, had Canadian soldiers with guns to their heads. This battle was one that nobody else could even dream of taking, and made Sir Arthur Currie a national hero, as him and Byng were the leaders of this offensive. And it said this is one of the first times in military history that a battle was practiced the way it was. It was the first time Canadians that weren't officers and higher-ups received maps and received all the information for the battle. And because of this, the Canadians succeeded. It's even said that one of the kind of road building and infrastructure divisions, who all they were known as is just building things and constructing things, were thrust into battle when one of the Canadian divisions was almost fully wiped out. And it really raised that division, that you know, stature of that group. This battle became one of the greatest Canadian triumphs in history. And it is one of the things that eventually led to a growing Canadian identity, and is one of the things many people say is the pivotal Canadian moment. There's even stories that Adolf Hitler, who actually visited it in 1940, didn't want to destroy it, as they put a statue there, and even he thought it was a beautiful statue. That's saying something, that even Hitler himself thought it was a beautiful statue and just didn't want to touch it. Now, after one of the other reasons Vimy is such an icon is because after it, there was a construction of the Vimy Memorial by master sculptor Walter Aylward of Toronto. Many sites were considered for memorial to Canada's involvement and sacrifice in the war. Vimy was ultimately selected because of its elevated geographic and panoramic views, which included the tunnels and trenches and the cemetery filled with Canadian war dead. After winning the commission in 1921, Aylward spent years scouring the world for limestone with the right combination of color, luminosity, and durability, and he eventually sourced it from an ancient Roman quarry in Croatia. Construction began in 1925, and it took 11 years to complete. Aylward oversaw every detail of the work, including the carving of the massive 27-meter twin pylons with the 20 allegorical statues, which he considered prototypical Canadian values. Breaking of the sword, spirit of sacrifice, mourning parents, sympathy of the Canadians for the helpless, and most famously, Mother Canada mourning her dead. Inscribed on the outside wall of the monument were the names of the 11,285 Canadians killed in France during World War I, whose bodies were never recovered or properly buried. The France actually gave this hill and made it part of Canadian territory. It's a beautiful statue that is considered just a beautiful icon of Canadians, and it is an extremely well-known statue itself. And I believe it is on the back of the $20 bill. And I know it's on the, if not the 20, it's on the back of one of our bills. And recently, when they had the 75th anniversary of a lot of the battles, I believe in 2017, they had the 100-year anniversary of the Battle of Vimy Ridge, where they had dignitaries from Canada, they had war vets, I believe even some people from France, visit the memorial to rededicate it. 100 years after, Canadians fought and died during the First World War for Canadians and people abroad. This is one of the pivotal battles, and it wouldn't be the last. During the Second World War, on the shores of Normandy, Canadians would take a beach and would go very far in and do more than many other countries could, and would solidify themselves as a capable fighting force. Eventually, they would liberate the Netherlands, and Canada quickly became a country known not to be messed with. I really recommend people go online and look up documentaries or read articles about Canadians during the war, as it is very inspiring. This last thing I'm going to say is I'm going to ask you, what poem is this? As I think it's an important one. In Flanders fields the poppies blow, between the crosses row on row, that mark our place, and in the sky the larks, still bravely singing, fly. Scarce heard amid the guns below, we are the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe, to you from failing hands we throw the torch, be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields.